Hey everyone, it's April 30th, 2017, and this is your episode 95 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me as usual are my co-hosts, Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Ben Charles, how's it going?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you, Casey?
Just fine. Megan Arns, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Let's hear about this recital.
I just played a recital!
So was this your recital to, like, finish at Eastman?
Yeah, so I have one last thing, which is the oral exam tomorrow, and then I'm done. So it's exciting.
Okay.
But yeah, it went well. It was cool. A lot of the studio was there and some of my former teachers and stuff. And I was very passionate about the topic also. I really enjoyed researching it. So it was a lot of fun.
Wow. What was the topic?
It was, the title is called Time is Times, Balinese Influence and the Infinity Series in Per Norgaard's I Ching. So, yeah, I was in the gamelan here at Eastman. And so to me, in that fourth movement, especially in the third movement too, there's just so much Balinese influence. And Norgaard, I think I talked about this last week, Ben, but you weren't here. I think I talked about this, but...
You did.
Yeah, so very briefly, it's just there are gong cycles and interlocking parts and things and lots of stuff. So it was a good lecture recital topic, I think. And it was extra special because they have a gamelan concert on Monday, so the gamelan teacher is actually here, and so he came to the recital. And afterwards, I was like, did I get it all right? Is it all right? You know, and he was like, yeah, it was really good. It's like, okay. That was really the person I needed to get past. So,
Megan, I'm worried that once you're Dr. Arns, you and Ben are going to snicker and laugh behind Laurel and I's back, and there's going to be all this terminology that we just don't understand. And...
Yeah. Like, they give you a pill, I heard, after you get the degree, and then, yeah, after you get the degree, then you're smarter.
I see. Well, you guys, listen, Beverly Johnston is one of Canada's leading percussion virtuosos, and just personally,
correction,
I'll say,
one of the world's leading percussion virtuosos.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right. No, absolutely. And I'm getting to a little more of that here down in the bottom of the introduction here. But if you're just discovering through this podcast Beverly Johnston, you're going to be so happy, because I know when I discovered her, it was like, whoa, I just found this gem of a performer in so many different ways that the feeling was like, right, where has this type of performer been in my education and my life and my artistry? So her recordings, which include 6 solo CDs, the latest of which is titled Woman Runs with Wolves. These are available from the Canadian Music Center, Steve Weiss Music, iTunes, and Amazon. She tours and performs all over the world, like Ben said. She's commissioned and prepared many upon many of new pieces and is herself a very talented composer. She teaches at the University of Toronto, and in honor of her exemplary commitment to the music of Canadian composers, she's been awarded the distinction of Canadian Music Center Ambassador. So, Bev, how are you? It's so good to have you on the show.
Is that me? I don't know. I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. So I'm glad the weather is allowing for this connection. And how's everything happening there in Toronto?
Well, our place is actually about an hour north of Toronto. We live in a little community called Uxbridge, but Toronto itself is doing really well. It's become a real cosmopolitan city over the past few years, so it's a great place to live, and the music culture in Toronto is quite diverse, so I really love being amidst all that. Yeah.
What's coming up for you? What's the latest and greatest project you're working on right now?
Well, a bigger project that I'm trying to get happening is my next recording. So I just have to find a good producer and a good venue. So I've got a few things up my sleeve that I'd like to be recording. And as per usual, the summer is filled with some festival work. So I have about 5 or 6 places that I'll be performing in the summertime. So I have to get in my practice studio and start practicing. I'm just ending up the University of Toronto. I'm the interim head of percussion at U of T right now, so that's been a real learning experience for me. I'm used to just the teaching part of it, but I started to get into a little bit of the administration too, so yeah.
Wow, very cool. Good for you. Well, we do have one question from Facebook I wanted to get to right away. This one's from Laurel Black, and it says, what's it like having a husband that writes cool percussion music?
He's right over here.
Oh, okay. Well, perfect.
Well done, Laurel.
Yeah, well, good job, Laurel. She didn't do anything. That's all me.
That's all Casey.
We're pretty laid back around here.
Well, that's how we got together, actually. I know, Laurel, that you're going to be playing Fertility Rites coming up. Or have you already performed?
Yeah, it'll be in October.
Oh, okay, great. I hope you're enjoying the learning process. The reason I talk about Fertility Rites is because that's the first piece that Christos wrote for me back in 1997. And that's basically how we got together in the first place, because I had commissioned him to write the piece, and it was the first year I had taught at the University of Toronto. So we were there, both of us were there, and decided to collaborate on this piece. And I have to admit, the first performance, the third movement, which is probably the most difficult, as you know, was given to me 3 weeks before the actual performance. So,
wow,
I wasn't with that, but managed to pull through, and it was a CBC broadcast too, which added a little more pressure to the experience. But it all. It all worked out, and subsequently that piece has been one of his most popular marimba pieces that he's composed. He's done a couple since then, but Fertility Rites put his music on the map in the percussion world, I think.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, yeah. Speaking of pieces with electronic accompaniment, I wanted to ask you about one piece in particular that I believe was written for you. I think you premiered it, which is kind of an unknown work, I think, for too many people, called Steal the Thunder by Jean Pitch. Okay.
Jean Pitch. I'm glad you didn't pronounce his name Jean Pitch.
But yeah, are the other guy, are the other people here? Are you guys familiar with this work?
Yeah, I love that piece.
It's like, it's a daunting piece. It's for primarily timpani, but with some opera gongs and other percussion things. And I think one of the reasons it's often not performed is you have to have opera gongs that bend up to a specific pitch, which is kind of hard to find. And then I've heard the notation of the electronics doesn't match up very well with what actually happens, and you kind of have to make your own counts and things. But anyway, if you could tell us about your experience with that piece.
Well, this was quite a while ago, back in the 80s. I got into the new music scene quite a bit through a CBC producer, CBC meaning Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and he premiered a lot of Canadian music on his radio show. And one of the pieces that he thought was really interesting was this Steal the Thunder piece. So he asked me if I'd be interested in performing it. So I had the opportunity back, I think it might have been 1985, 1986, and that's when I started working on the piece. It was actually originally written for Sal Ferreras, commissioned by Vancouver New Music Society. So it wasn't a piece that I commissioned. It was done by the Vancouver New Music Society, but I had the opportunity to record it on my first recording called The Impact. And it was really interesting working with Jean. At the time, the computer-generated material was from his Fairlight, I think it was called. So it was like a pretty sophisticated piece of electronic equipment, computer equipment back in those days. So when so I recorded it a couple of times. First time just for a radio broadcast, and then when I actually did the CD recording, Jean Pichet was there, and it was funny because he wanted to experiment a little bit with the piece while we were recording it, and I love the piece, and I love what he did with the timpani part, but he kept on going, well, can you just, I'd like to hear this at an octave higher. Can you just take that part up the octave? You know, I mean, he basically do that with timpani. It's not like a keyboard, right? So anyways, that was interesting. But I had a good time learning the piece. I wouldn't call myself an experienced timpani player, but for me, that piece is kind of like rock and roll timpani, and it's a real opportunity just to experience that kind of playing in a more classical music setting.
And was that piece originally written for just a performer, or was there dance that went along to it?
Oh, that's a good question.
It might have just been originally for a performer, but William Mersch had a great story about it. I think he did the New York premiere of it. And they did it with dancers. And he said, like, the first time, I don't know, the first time he played or the first time the electronics kicked in or whatever, he said all these ballerinas just jumped because they weren't used to the noises that loud.
I remember that now, yeah. Choreographer John Elaine, who was with BC Ballet at the time and then was with the National Ballet, had taken two pieces. He took Gary Kulesh's piece called Angels for marimba and audio playback, and the Steal the Thunder piece, and choreographed both those pieces. Yeah. Gotcha. I forgot about that. That's interesting.
Ben, I think you were going to talk about a composer that Beverly has done some things with, right?
Yeah, that was a very smooth segue there, Casey.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, sometimes you, yeah.
Yeah, so when I was researching something to talk about with Bev on the show, I looked at her website and I saw her repertoire list, and there was one piece that I immediately went, oh, I remember that, you know, that was written for her now. And that piece was Te Tuma Te Papa by Michael Colgrass. And Michael Colgrass is one of my sort of favorite figures in percussion, because he's just has such an unusual history of how he got to where he is, which I'll talk about a little bit here. But if you're interested in Michael Colgrass, there's a PAS article in Percussive Notes, volume 34, number 4, from August 1996, called Small Essay on My Early Percussion Music by Michael Colgrass. And he has just, it's like a little snippet about each of his early percussion works. And there was a great sort of little anecdote about how John Cage thought Three Brothers was some sort of huge statement on humanity, and he just ripped the title from like some jazz tune. But anyway, I just wanted to give a quick little overview and then hear Bev maybe talk about her experience with that work. So Michael Colgrass was born April 22nd, 1932 in Chicago, Illinois, which means just last week he celebrated his 85th birthday. He grew up studying to be a jazz drummer, actually, and he started gigging at the age of 12 in Chicago. When he turned 18, when he graduated high school, he attended the University of Illinois. And I was actually fortunate to meet Mr. Colgrass and hear him talk about his experience, but on his website, he has a little quote about it. And instead of trying to recount in my own words, I thought I would just read what Mr. Colgrass wrote about his first year at the University of Illinois. He says on his website, "When I saw Smith Music Hall today, my memory floated back to my first days as a music student in 1950, which were a disaster. I was mainly a jazz musician then and played six nights a week. I would get to bed around 3 a.m. and come sauntering to school about 11 a.m. And I'd say, hey, man, what's happening? Well, man, your first theory class happened at 8 a.m. and your music history class happened at 10. In my first semester, I flunked hygiene, phys ed, and band, and my music theory teacher told me, Michael, I'm giving you a D because I think you really tried. When I returned my second semester, my percussion teacher, Paul Price, said, oh no, he's back. And a last-ditch effort to get me to turn around, he urged me to come to a percussion ensemble concert to hear my colleagues play right here in Smith Hall. After the concert, we met out in the lobby, and he asked me what I thought about the concert of Varese, Cowell, Cage, and Harrison. I said, in my at-that-time typical upstart manner, well, I really admired the skill of the musicians, but I thought the music was terrible. So he said, well, if you don't like what you heard, why don't you write what you'd like to hear? And that was how he started as a composer, sort of this dare from Paul Price. And so he has a lot of these early percussion works from like 1950 to 1954-ish that were written while he was a student at U of I, including Three Brothers. And so he graduated in 1954 with a degree in percussion and composition. During his studies, he also studied with Darius Milhaud at the Aspen Music Festival and Lucas Foss at Tanglewood. After he graduated, he served 2 years as a timpanist in the 7th Army Orchestra in Stuttgart, Germany, followed by 11 years of freelancing in New York City to support himself as a composer. While he was freelancing, he had diverse performance experiences with the New York Philharmonic, American Ballet Theater, Dizzy Gillespie, the original West Side Story Orchestra on Broadway, and under Stravinsky for a series of recordings of Stravinsky Conducts Stravinsky. He organized percussion sections for Gunther Schuller and premieres of new works by Cage, Carter, Varese, and others. While he was in New York City, he continued to study composition with two people I had never heard of, Wallingford Rieger and Ben Weber. As a composer, he has received commissions from the New York Philharmonic, Boston Symphony, Minnesota Orchestra, San Francisco Symphony, St. Louis Symphony, and Toronto Symphony, among others. So basically any major orchestra in the U.S. He's developed a system of graphic notation to help children compose music. He's authored two books called Michael Colgrass, Adventures of an American Composer, and My Lessons with Kumi, which are both excellent and very easy reads if you're interested. He also has a blog with a lot of sort of similar anecdotes to those books. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1978 for his percussion quartet concerto called Deja Vu, which was written for the New York Philharmonic with the timpanist and percussion section as soloists. He was inducted into the PAS Hall of Fame in 1987. And his percussion works, which I actually dug up a few that weren't listed on his website. The first four of these were written while he was a student at U of I. Three Brothers from 1951, which is three percussion soloists with a percussion sextet accompaniment. Concertino for timpani from 1953, which was a timpani concerto with brass septet and two percussionists. Percussion Music from 1953 for percussion quartet. Chamber Music for a percussion quintet from 1954. Six unaccompanied solos for snare drum in 1955. Inventions on a Motive from 1955 also for percussion quintet. Variations for four drums and viola, it's a duo, from 1957. Fantasy Variations from 1961 for solo percussion with percussion sextet. Rhapsodic Fantasy from 1964 for solo percussion with orchestra, which I've never heard of until today. Deja Vu from 1977, which was the percussion quartet concerto that won him the Pulitzer Prize. A piece called A Flute in the Kingdom of Drums and Bells, which was written for flute virtuoso Maria Piccinini and Nexus. Te Tuma Te Papa, which is a very extended multi-percussion solo, which he wrote for Bev Johnston in 1994. And the most recent one from 2008 is called Pan Trio. It's a trio for steel drums, harp, and one player playing marimba and vibraphone. So those are the Michael Colgrass percussion works, which, like I said, many of those I hadn't heard of until today. I'm very curious to hear the timpani concerto with the chamber brass group as well as the percussion concerto. But Bev, could you tell us about working with Michael Colgrass on Te Tuma Te Papa?
Right. Well, fabulous experience. As you know, Michael has lived in Toronto for many, many years, and he had this old house in the annex area, which is close to the University of Toronto, and he and his wife Ula lived there for over 30 years, probably. I'll get to the piece, but I just kind of want to set it up a little bit. And now they live down by the waterfront in a beautiful condo facing Lake Ontario. So they're really doing very well. So I worked with Michael on the piece, and I think some of my favorite experiences were, he of course knows how to write for percussion beautifully. With all the experience that he's, but the movement of Te Tuma Te Papa that I probably had the most fun with was the piano movement. I can't remember which movement. I haven't played the piece in so many years, so I have to refresh my memory actually. But the piano movement, we worked together on that because he had to figure out what works. It basically it's a prepared piano with bobby pins and inverted salad bowls and wrenches, kind of similar to the John Cage prepared piano concept, but definitely more whimsical in nature is Michael's piece. And so we worked together on it. And then on the upper portion of the piano, where usually the music goes, I had a bunch of wood blocks and triangles. So I would kind of go in between playing the piano and then the wood block triangle part. And then I'd be on the inside of the piano doing what I had to there. So Michael and I would spend hours at his up near the attic area of his old house, and we'd be fiddling around with the piano trying to figure out how this is going to work. So for me, that was one of the favorite parts. But then those were the years when I was playing a lot more multiple percussion. I still am, but not quite as extensively. I find as I get older, carting the equipment around isn't as appealing as it used to be. I don't know if it was ever appealing, but nonetheless, yes. So it was a great experience all around. He's just such a wonderful person, and I really got to know him well, and to just kind of talk to him about other things, about life as a musician. And as you know, he's a wonderful speaker and public speaker, and he works with not just musicians, but with anybody who's interested in public speaking. He really helps them out in their journey, you know. So I just had a wonderful time, and his wife Ula is also a wonderful person and very intelligent and good writer. So those years were really great, and we've kept in touch over the years. I have to mention a piece that I heard recently of his. It's not a percussion work, but speaking of Arctic Dreams, he has a piece called Arctic Dreams for wind ensemble with percussion, and there's some vocalization in the piece also. And the UFT Wind Ensemble did it, I think it might have been last year or the year before, and I was just blown away. His sense of orchestration is unbelievable. It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
Yeah, when I met him, we did Winds of Nagual and Urban Requiem, which are just both, I mean, Rite of Spring level masterpieces, just ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Christos has talked to Michael and said, I just, you know, he says, I need to take lessons from you. You know, it's just, what he does is just, nobody does that, you know. The last time I heard anything wind ensemble-wise that was like that was when I heard Joseph Schwantner's wind ensemble music, forgot the name, but there, you know, it just a real great sense of texture and color.
Speaking of both Christos and Joseph Schwantner, I would play Fertility Rites for my music appreciation course, class of about, this evening class was smaller, it was about 30 people, and I seem to always have a class fall on Halloween, and this was the evening class, so it was dark, I'd turn out all the lights, and I'd play Fertility Rites for them, and we would just listen to the first movement in the dark, and then we'd also listen to Joseph Schwantner and The Mountains Rising Nowhere. And we didn't quite do the whole piece on that one, but oh yeah, they had a lot of questions. Yeah, I think as soon as they hear the throat singing, you know, as soon as the piece is over, the first question is like, so what the hell was that sound? They just had no idea. It's just,
well, the very beginning, it basically is just the Inuit throat singers. He recorded them and then he slowed down the sound, so it sounds like a heavy breathing.
Yeah. Did he? I imagine you're tired of talking about this piece because it's probably the one that people, you know, like you said, it is has become a staple, and it is the one that, you know, everyone really knows. But was that out in the field recording? Or did he bring someone into a controlled environment to record those sounds?
Well, he in 1995 went up to Iqaluit, up in Baffin Island. With another CBC producer, They recorded so many different things. They recorded, of course, the Inuit throat singers. They also recorded just sound of nature, and then they also talked with the elders of the community. And so there was a period where Christos, and he's actually gone back to this these themes with the recent pieces, but back in the later 90s, he was doing a whole series of pieces based on the Inuit culture. There's one called Idea of Canada, so it was like a music documentary. So you'd hear the music in the background, and then you'd hear an elder of the community talking about life in the Arctic. And then it would go back to the music. And so Christos basically took all the information and then manipulated the sounds on his computer. So that's basically how Fertility writes.
Yeah, great. Megan, I think you had a question for Bev, didn't you?
No, I was just curious of how you got your start in percussion, you know, how old you were and, like, what your story is in the beginning.
Oh, well, thanks for the question. Probably the same as you, maybe. I just picked it in high school. It was the instrument that I felt just really spoke to me, and it was instant gratification because, we tried all the instruments, and I was, like, trying to play the oboe, and I couldn't make it sound. So, and then when percussion came, it was like, oh, yeah, that works. So, and then I had piano background before that, so I started piano lessons at the age of 7. I quit at the age of 10 because that's what my sister did, and I did everything my sister did. And but then I was attracted to the piano. I'd be drawn to the piano like a magnet when I was from 10, the age of 10. Through my teenage years. So I just kept up with my piano playing. And at that time was also playing percussion in concert band. But it wasn't until college. I grew up in Montreal, Quebec, and it wasn't until college that I really took percussion seriously and started taking lessons then. And then I just followed my nose. I basically wanted to get away from my parents when I, like most of us, and decided to go to the University of Toronto. I was accepted at McGill, but I just wanted to get out of Montreal. And so I had no idea what I was getting into. My parents said, if you want to study music, you have to be in music education because you're not going to make a living as a performer. So I went through the music education degree. And in the meantime, there was Russ Hardenberger there from Nexus. Little did I know. Somebody in Montreal said, oh, do you know that it's Nexus Percussion Ensemble that's in Toronto and Russ Hardenberger teaches? I was like, what? I don't know. I was in it for the music education. But I honestly fell in love with Russ and his and Nexus and that whole scene. And in fact, just a little aside, in the month of October, so this was a month after I had arrived in Toronto, Russ said to me, oh, I'm going to this little studio in Yorkville, which is really close to the university, and we're doing a recording there. Do you want to sit in? And so I thought, oh, okay, nervous little kid. And it was the Ragtime recording that they did it at that, and at that time it was like a direct-to-disc recording. This is the precursor of CDs. So basically they had to go through one piece right after the other. So they had to do this whole side of one album in one take.
You were there for that?
Becker, you know, going from one tune to the next. And at that time, Michael Craden was in the ensemble, too. He passed away in the 80s. He had cancer, but he was the percussionist. He played all the little novelty toys in the Ragtime recording, and he improvised really beautifully, and he was also a visual artist, too. So so it's just a little situation that happened to me when I first arrived.
Wow.
Well, speaking of your background,
it is a historical event.
Oh, sorry. Say that again, Megan. I missed that.
It's a historical event.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it really was. I didn't know at the time, but I mean, I could tell by the playing. It was just flawless. Well, you know Bob Becker's playing. It was just, I couldn't believe that he was doing this. And, well, the rest of them, too.
Yeah, MVP was just saying that he subbed for Bill because he hurt his knee, I think.
That would happen. I was wondering. Yeah, because I saw Michael doing drumming with the other guys. So, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and he just said, yeah, Bob just, like, his hands are just still ridiculous. It's just insane.
Yeah.
It's so hard for me to believe, like, everything was not only done in one take, but in one take altogether.
Yeah. Russ has a great story about Michael Craden when he's playing on his little percussion toys, and he had this tambourine that he was playing on, and you know, one of the students had seen the tambourine, and it just had duct tape all over it, and the student was just in awe of the incredible sound that he got on his tambourine.
Oh yeah.
So there was a hole in the tambourine, so I put duct tape on it, you know. Anyway,
just the right amount of duct tape.
Yeah,
not too much. Not
that's what you need, duct tape.
Not too little. My microphone has some duct tape on it. Just get it just right.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little bit. Hey, well, Bev, speaking of your background and the timeline, we do have a cool question from Dave Friedman, and that's right, the Dave Friedman for the listeners. He says, I was so impressed by the repertoire section of your website. You play no traditional marimba compositions, which I think there were a few listed there.
Yeah.
How different and how refreshing. So, yeah, speaking of, we haven't talked about you as a marimbist too much, but I think that's certainly what I first knew you as, and I think what a lot of people, what they might first bump into you as. So can you speak to Dave's question at all?
Well, I was honored that he would say that, and I think I answered back on Facebook that I'm a big admirer of his work and Double Image and all that, and he's a wonderful musician, first and foremost. I think for me, I'm not sure why I never really ventured into the typical repertoire that other percussionists were playing, but I think partially it was just when I was at the University of Toronto, I'd end up doing all the contemporary music concerts. They'd ask me to play percussion, so I became friendly with a lot of the composers, and then, you know, next thing that happens is they're writing me little pieces, and basically that's what I enjoy doing. I don't, like you said, composer. I don't find myself to be a composer. I do structured improvisations, but I love to be in the process of the creation, which means I really enjoy workshopping with composers and trying to figure my way around different technical issues in a brand new piece, knowing what the intention of the composer is, but maybe a way of doing it a little more idiomatically. So that's something that has appealed to me over the years, and I think that's why I kind of stuck with trying to commission as many works myself as possible.
Yeah, sure. Hey, thank you so much for sending the music to All Too Consuming.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
And yes, I've done a lot of work with Diana McIntosh. She's a real special person.
Yep, she sent me the CD, and she sent me another CD of some of her other work. So you guys were doing a Canadian-themed contemporary music festival coming up in October.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, I'm gonna learn this piece by Diana McIntosh that I'm really excited about and have wanted to do for some time now. And yeah, just we have this Google Doc of, man, it's gotten pretty big. A lot of people wanting to do a whole bunch of Canadian composer pieces, and we actually have, I think Laura and I counted this morning, four faculty from Canada here.
Oh.
And I was going to ask you if you happen to know a percussionist named Jeff Bush. I know Canada's a big place, but
do you know where he's from?
No, and I should know. He's my boss, so I'll be editing this out.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I know you also are doing Kelly Marie Murphy's music. Is that
correct? Yeah, and she'll be our guest. She'll be here.
She's a great composer. Yeah.
Yeah,
and Nexus, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm real interested in getting to know her and getting to know her music because it's new to me. Christos was kind of the first person that came to mind when they said Canada. So.
That's who I put on the table. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Laurel, what do you have for us today? I think you have a little something.
I do. Yeah. First, I have a question for Beb, and this is kind of along the lines of, how the thing that people first see of yours that where they're like, "Wow, look at what Beb's doing." I remember seeing you at PASIC years ago, and I just thought, she's so cool. Like, she's doing these things that are so cool and so brave. And so one of my questions to kind of lead into my topic, which does very much kind of bounce off Dave Friedman, is, not playing the standard things. And you said composers just kept writing music. And as you started to feel compelled to include your voice or theatrics and things like that, were these... just choices that came naturally, or did you just decide one day to include them? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I can't think right now exactly when I started to do things like that, but I have been encouraged over the years by different people to pursue theater a little bit. So what has happened is that I've been curious about many different things throughout my career, and it's not just been about music. And I've been involved in different organizations, in which just so happened to focus on theatrical music combined with theater, music combined with visual arts, music combined with dance. It's freed me up a little bit to kind of explore that part of my repertoire, solo repertoire. I have also been encouraged by, I remember this, he's since passed away, but a fellow named George Bloomfield, who was quite a well-known film and television director in Canada, and his wife is a wonderful visual artist. And but he told me that I should definitely pursue acting a little bit. Back in 2005, I started getting really severe shoulder problems from playing, and I had to kind of cut back on just some of the more powerhouse percussion pieces that I was playing. I was playing like Maki Ishii, stuff like that. So I had to find another way of expressing myself, and I think that opened up to some of this more theatrical stuff. And then the piece, I don't know if you're talking about this one called Snare Drama, where I get up there and I'm basically making out with a snare drum. It's kind of crazy, ridiculous.
I love that piece.
I like that piece too. Yeah, I want to do that one.
Because of that and then so many friends, it's like polar opposite, But the thing is, it was just... The reason that piece came about is because Russ Hartenberger had every semester a thing called Snare Drum Olympics, and it was a way of getting the students to practice the snare drum a bit more. And one of these segments of Snare Drum Olympics is the creative segment, where you have to make up a piece. And he always has a topic for that. And that year, the topic was snare drama. And I just went... okay, this will be my revenge on the snare drum, because I don't like playing the snare drum. So I just kind of worked out some ridiculous thing where I dress up as a guy and the girl is the snare drum, and you can hear my voice on the audio playback, and she's going like, "Have you ever turned on a snare drum?" go ahead, turn me on. And, you know, it's just all these kind of crazy things that go on and just gets out of control. But
that's great.
So well, it's just silliness.
I have a quick little anecdote to share before Laurel does her topic, because Bev was talking about encouraging people so much. And Bev, you probably don't remember this, but I actually met Bev for the very first time at PASIC, I think it was 2006. And what happened is I was hanging out with Brian Calhoun. It's when Brian and I first met. And we were walking down the street, and Bev recognized Brian from ZMF. And she was like, can I go to dinner with you guys? I just got here. So I had no idea who she was at the time, and I was like, sure. And that was when
old edgy woman.
that was when Brian first started doing the marimba and voice stuff, and he was talking to Bev about it, and she was like, yeah, I think you should totally go for it. And it was like uncharted territory what Brian was doing, and she was very encouraging. So it was a cool little like historical moment knowing what Brian is doing now that Bev was so encouraging of that at the early stages.
Well, I keep up. I see
guest number one. Yes, Brian was our first guest on the podcast ever.
No kidding. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
With his career, I see on Facebook, you know, some of the things that he's doing. I think it's wonderful. Yeah. He was a lot of fun. He is a lot of fun.
Well, my topic today comes from the latest issue I received of Mindful Magazine. So I often bring up topics out of here. You guys know that I've love this. And it just so happens that there are a number of topics in this issue that have to do with your inner artist and creativity. And not from purely a psychological standpoint, but where creativity comes from, what drives it, and how others affect it. And they write about this both in little surveys and in a short article that I want to share with you guys about creativity in the workplace. But I thought a cool way to start and to just keep everyone talking would be to ask you some of the questions that they asked the readers of the magazine. And then I'll let you know what the results are of the survey in here, keeping in mind that the people answering these questions are the type of people that would subscribe to a magazine called Mindful Magazine.
So hippies, you mean?
Because that already tells you it might be a very particular type of person. But first question, do you believe creativity is learned or inherent? Casey and I were talking about this morning, and we both thought, well, maybe kind of learned, but mostly inherent.
It seems like the... Do you want us to shout out our thoughts and answers,
sure,
or do you want us
sure,
to say...
Yeah.
The more I learn about stuff like this, I would say learned.
See, and I think there's a scale, and I think it's more, I think neither word is quite appropriate.
Yeah,
yeah.
But if I had to pick one of the words, it's closer to learned than inherent. And
maybe nurtured is a better word than learned.
Right, exactly. Like there's two sides to that. Like, because there's plenty of people who are creative. I think everyone is really creative. It maybe takes nourishment, encouragement, and practice to get it out. So I don't know. It's very hard to put it in those two terms.
Mm-hmm. It's very much depending on your environment too. I find that there will be periods where I'm not being creative, and then when I'm around creative people or I'm feeling inspired or something, then that comes out. You know, like I know it's in there. I know that there's a part of it that's inherent, but you know, I think it depends on the environment sometimes as well.
Of the results of this survey, 46% of people think it's inherent, 14% think it's learned, and 40% say, not sure, I don't know.
Huh.
So interesting.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they're looking at the term creativity, they're looking for the results and like the final product. Like, are you someone who produces paintings and they go out and they're passed around and, oh, that's a creative person? But of course, we all know there's so many other ways of being creative, and you might paint and throw it away. You're still just as creative, you know?
Right. Well, and I think I think of the word creativity, and I think of the thought process and the need to make or to synthesize something, not necessarily the production. So, I don't know. That's just my brain. Second question. There are only three. so we're almost done. Does your creativity thrive in peace or chaos?
This test is hard. Probably peace.
Mine is peace. What about you, Bev?
Peace.
Yeah, I'd agree.
For sure.
So we're with the 61% of people that said their creativity thrives in peace. Only 8% said that they can really be creative amidst chaos. But 31% of people said it doesn't matter.
Can I say something about this real quick?
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't done one of my classic Casey Talks About South Parks in a while. I know you guys are really missing that. So here's a classic Casey Talks About a lesson from South Park. Creatives of South Park say that you shouldn't smoke weed because smoking weed makes you happy with being bored, and you need boredom in order to create something. Boredom is really, really valuable because that's your body telling you, hey, get off the couch and learn a skill. Get off the couch and get good at piano. Get off the couch and pick up an instrument. So they're saying it doesn't matter if it's health or whatever. The harm is that it would make you content with being bored. And I think you need boredom in order to be creative, which is why ours would thrive and everyone's would thrive when you are at peace and the air is calm or whatever. South Park.
Makes a lot of sense.
Brilliant.
I love that.
Final question. Are you more creative by yourself or with others?
That's the most on the fence one for sure.
Yeah, I think definitely by myself.
I'm often inspired by others, but the actual creativity happens alone.
I'd agree with Megan.
Yeah. What about you, Casey?
Shows a nice point that creativity is a complicated thing because inspiration is part of it. Others could inspire you. Again, it's like the words don't adequately describe the complexity of what the whole thing is. So of course you do need both, but I think the root of the word in the simplest terms, yeah, by yourself.
Yeah, and we're in the 74% of people that said they certainly feel more creative by themselves than with other people. I got to wondering if that's like, wait, is this a like group project type of creative stuff, or is this just talking about inspiration? Because I would think it would be pretty rare that you're not inspired by some third party something, you know, taking it and making it your own. Yeah, it also fits into the next small little article, which is the final thing I want to share with you guys. And it has to do with what all of us do, and that we're in creative fields in a way to try to make a living. Simply because no matter what workplace you find yourself in, there are certain things that happen that can zap positivity and energy, particularly creative energy, even if your job is not, by definition, a creative artistic one. And so I think putting ourselves in the position of having a creative job, losing that energy is perhaps a bit more worrisome, or it can really kind of derail what we're doing a bit more than other things. So the writer, Jay Ellard, lists five creative energy zappers, as she calls them. Just go through them quickly. One, drama. Two is perfection, like working in a place that doesn't leave any room for mistakes. Can really zap your creative energy. Sometimes I do that to my own brain. Like my brain is a place that doesn't allow for mistakes, and I have to remind it to stop doing that. Third, yeah, to always focus on what's wrong. Four is ambiguous boundaries, expectations, and communication in the workplace, especially if you're supposed to work with people on a project. The fifth is needing to control everything around you, and whether this comes from ego and the need to put your stamp on all of it, or it comes from a place of fear because you don't want other people to possibly see you mess up, doesn't matter. The need to control is still there, and that's the fifth thing that can be most energy zapping. And Casey and I were talking about this earlier today, and I'm sure you guys can all pitch in about this, that one of the things we get talked to quite a bit about at the university is collaboration with each other, with other departments, with departments that are not performing arts specific. And I think about that and all that's entailed, and then I look at this list and ponder the actual process of collaboration with people when you're doing it specifically just to do it, to put it on your resume as something you did, that it has the potential to be something that's incredibly negative in a creative workplace. And I feel funny saying that, but there could be so much drama in that. The communication can be really unclear. And then depending on how the people are, there can be this power struggle that leaves people just kind of chit-chatting and only pointing out flaws. And that's four of the five things that this particular writer lists. So I'm curious to know what you guys think of that. Like, do you view collaboration in the creative workplace as a good thing? Does it sometimes annoy you? What are your experiences with it?
I love it because it gets us out of our little bubbles, you know? I think the way, you know, when you're describing it, like, it definitely should be a positive thing. I mean, it's like, it shouldn't be forced, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, if there's an idea, if you have an idea, I think we have sometimes, at least me, I have to work hard to think outside of our bubble, right? I'm like, really, but some of my most meaningful projects have been with people outside of the bubble. So I think it definitely can be a good thing and a positive thing and can help us all learn more about what each other do, you know, what we do, but it shouldn't be forced, or it shouldn't just be like a buzzword now, you know, like applying for grants just because you need to collaborate, or doing outreach just because that's going to win you a grant.
Buzzword is the only problem I have with it, I think. Yeah. I think you nailed it right on the head. I find people will try to collaborate, and in doing so, all they will do is talk about collaborating for months. Yeah. And it's basically a academic wrestling match of who can talk more about cool ideas, and nothing gets done. I've seen that, but you know, I think Megan's exactly right. Like that graphic score collaboration we did here, that just came up organically, and it was very practical this first time around. We each did, I think, just the right amount of work we wanted to. And next time we do it, it's going to be easier, and we'll probably get to make it better. And yeah, it achieved what Megan said. It got me outside of my little box, and was great for the students, was great for us. And yeah, what do you got there, Ben?
Bev, did you have something first?
No, go ahead.
Okay. To me, with collaboration, I think of it a lot of how I remember when I was in high school, integrating technology into the classroom was a really big thing. And my best teacher in high school was a history teacher that just lectured. No technology at all, didn't even write on the board, just spoke. And then there were other teachers that could use a PowerPoint presentation very effectively. And I don't think that one discounts the other in any way. Some people decide to do many collaborations, and it's very productive and it's very good. And other people prefer to do fewer. And I don't think that any one or the other is better than the other. And I think the problem is, like we've talked about before, like forcing it, like making it a buzzword that we have to have interdepartmental collaboration or something, then I think it just gets ruined. So yeah, I think it's very much, if it's organic, great, but if it's not, don't do it. That's fine too.
Yeah, so from the ground up, like the idea comes first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's that, like, there've been music and, you know, different collaborations within music and outside of music for years. I mean, for like literally centuries, with ballet and opera and things, like especially drama has been incorporated into music. I don't think it's any sort of new catchy buzzword thing. I think it's just universities have kind of latched onto that.
I don't know if any of you have read the book by Julia Cameron, The Arts Way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That really helped me a lot. And with the statement that you just said, Laurel, I found that book was really helpful, doing the morning pages that you have to do, and it just kind of was really cathartic, and then I could go into my studio and do what I had to do without worrying about this and that, and I just, that was great for me.
Yeah, I love that book.
Have to search for things that, you know, life is so challenging in some ways, you know, with all the other worries and what have you. And lately, you know, as I get older, there's a lot of responsibilities. So things like yoga and meditation and, just, you know, making sure that you're keeping yourself healthy. It's all part of it, being a good musician, too.
Now, that book is called The Artist's Way, right?
Yeah.
You've talked about that book several times, Laurel.
Yeah, I kind of summarized it on the podcast. And
yeah.
I've given it to a few students also, and they've really liked it.
Another book, I'm getting a little off topic here, but another book that I've always enjoyed is The Way of the Peaceful Warrior by Dan Millman, which I found out from Evelyn Glennie, actually. It's very similar to Michael Colgrass's book, My Lessons with Kumi. It's a story, but basically it's about an athlete who kind of loses his mojo and needs to find it, and he finds this gas station attendant who's very much into meditation and things like that. And it's just a great story. It's an easy read, but I that's kind of like my go-to book, kind of like my Bible to get through what I had to get through. So.
Cool. Well, good job, Laurel. Thanks. We're kind of getting towards the end. I'd love to get Bev saying a little more. Bev, is there anything else you'd just like to tell us about?
For number one, I really want to thank you for inviting me. I know we've talked for quite a while to be doing this, and finally I have the opportunity to share. Share some conversation with all of you. It's been really interesting. And I'm just a big admirer of all of your work, and want to say one other thing that kind of is important to me lately, both as a teacher and as a performer, about being a percussionist. I've always felt like I never was a typical performer. It's kind of weird. I mean, when you say percussion, people often think rhythm. And I've always felt that that hasn't been the thing that's propelled me as a percussionist.
Michael Colgrass, too, for that matter.
Yeah. He's that?
Yeah, Michael. Yeah.
Yeah, I find that I'm more of a pitch person or something like that. And through investigation, there's, you know, it's being a buzzword, but lately people have been talking about left brain, right brain function and all that. And I feel like I've been more of the right brain percussionist, because rhythm is on an organization from the left-hand side, I presume. But it's something that I like to investigate with my students also. I really find that emphasis on tone color and tone production on percussion is something that I've been fortunate enough to pursue a bit more, having studied with Nexus and Russell Hartenberger. So I really feel like I'd like to continue with that and investigate that a bit more in my teaching and also in my playing. I could spend hours trying to figure out a way of blurring the lines in sound. I find that really fascinating. So I'd like to investigate that a bit more in the future, in my ripe old age. So that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, wow, wonderful. Well, will we see you at PASIC?
I can't. I'm actually playing with the National Ballet Orchestra. I would love to go to PASIC because I was supposed to do the focus day. And but I got hired to do this. I would normally, because usually I get hired to play a triangle in the ballet, but this time it's the marimba book, and it's kind of fun. It's called The Winter's Tale. So it's been a successful ballet. We took it to the Lincoln Center last summer. So it's been a successful ballet for the National Ballet.
You know, we often will close with a little quote, and Ben just pointed out something that Katarzyna Miszka wrote on Facebook, and we always do a little call for questions. And Ben, why don't you tell us what Kashka said about Beverly Johnston?
Well, there's an emoji in there, so I'll have to say what the emoji is.
Well, you better do it with the right emotion.
Kashka said, "When do we meet again? Kissy face. You're an inspiration. It's not a question, just the fact."
Nice.
Coming from Kashka, that's like, whoa.
That's incredible.
I know.
But Mike Truesdale also said, Bev for president. And,
oh, yeah, right.
And also, was it Fernanda Meza said, "How does one apply so that in the next life I can come back as cool as you?"
Oh, yeah. I also have that question.
You see, he's the cool guy.
It's funny. There is this group of people that are just really talented, really laid back, and they all seem to know and like each other. It's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey. Hey, you guys, Beverly Johnston, thank you so much. It's been really great chatting with you and catching up again. And I'm sure I'll bump into you soon somehow.
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ben, Laurel, Megan, thanks so much. And we'll catch you all at 96. Okay. Bye, guys.
Cool. Bye.